This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Summer's end isn't all bad. It signals the start of leaf peeping season and the beginning of apple season. With cooler, crisper temperatures come pick-your-own Macintosh, Cortland's, Empire's, Honeycrisps, and Rome's. And you get to try varieties with exotic names like Lamb Abbey Pearmain, Calville Blanc, and Belle de Boscoop. A stroll through the farmer's markets or orchard stands offer photo-ready social media opportunities, those wooden crates full of shiny reds, greens, and yellows. Some apples are great for eating, and others are perfect for pies. Some are designed just to be used in cider, and they don't taste good at all if you eat them right off the tree. My favorite fall activity is to sample all the mysteries of the feral apple trees in the woods. I've had brilliant, tiny, juicy, and sweet little jewels, and I've had a few that I had to spit right out, ones that they made my mouth just totally dry. Maybe those were the cider apples. We're going to talk about all of them today on the show, and we could use your help. Tell us about your favorite apples. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a picture of your tree on our Facebook page. Terry Bradshaw, president of the Vermont Tree Fruit Growers Association, joins me now. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks.
So how's the season going this year?
The season's been actually fabulous this year. This is one of those years you can tell just by driving along the roadsides that it's a great apple year.
Apple year, great apple year. I mean, that sounds fabulous, but sometimes it's not the best thing to have tons and tons of apples on your trees. I mean, especially if you're just a home person with maybe two or three trees. We've actually seen trees with branches broken because they're so heavy with apples this year.
Yeah, and that's something people don't always realize. We do talk about, you know, whether it's a good apple year or a bad apple year, and it really comes down to the basic kind of botany of an apple tree. A wild apple tree, an unmanaged apple tree on the roadside, like a lot of folks are noticing right now, by its tendency tends to have large crops one year and smaller crops the next year. And that's really because the fruit – for the following year, so the fruit for 2016, were formed back in June of this year. So the tree makes its fruit buds the year prior to actually setting those fruit. So if the tree has to put a lot of resources into a large crop of fruit, it has less resources, less nutrients within itself to make next year's crop. And so a wild tree tends to kind of flood the system, and I've sort of thought about this a lot, and I think there's a few reasons, one of which I think is it allows the tree, you know, the only reason why the apple tree produces fruit is to spread itself, spread its population, you know, push seeds out. And by flooding the system in certain years, it allows for large production of seeds that will sort of outlive and make it past any of the pests, diseases, and other things that want to eat them before they become the seeds become ripe and ready to make a new apple tree.
Although, of course, the tree doesn't know that we may get a hailstorm the next spring or, you know, a hard frost in May.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's the thing about them being a perennial crop. I mentioned this in lectures and classes I have all the time. But apple trees are different from most of the crops we grow in Vermont. Grapes kind of follow along with this as well, in that, it's a crop that we're managing long term, and it's a crop that evolved to really run itself for the long term. So an apple tree, it doesn't really matter in the wild whether or not it has a crop of fruit this year or next. It just needs to have crops of fruit that will keep spreading those seeds. By adapting, management practices to reduce the number of fruit in heavy years, we can really kind of twist that tree into a form that fits for commercial production. And commercial production really started when we started to figure out a lot of the practices that are used, pruning and pest control and fertility and whatnot. But a lot of it came down to thinning. So it's a common practice in heavy years especially, but really in just about every year, for growers to remove a large portion of the fruit from the trees right after bloom and sometimes even during bloom in order to reduce the load on that tree so that the remaining fruit will be larger, will ripen better, will have better flavor, but also to ensure that a month later, a month after bloom, when the tree starts to provide fruit buds for the following year, that there's enough nutrients and there's enough to go around to create fruit buds for the next year. I like to say apple growers need a paycheck every year. They can't get one every other year.
Right. Right. So given that, so when you say this year is a great year, are you looking at those trees on the side of the road or those, as I call them, the feral apple trees in the woods to determine that? Or is there something, I mean, because if orchardists are trying to have a fairly regular and regulated season, so they kind of know, barring any unforeseen disasters, what kind of crop they're going to have and try to, you know, have it pretty consistent year after year. What does a good year mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, we are growing crops, you know, in nature. I mean, you know, as you walk out the door, even in an orchard, you're still part of the natural cycle of things. And, you know, when you talk about a good apple year, to some folks that means, yeah, the roadsides are littered with fruit. And for people who want to make cider and kind of make pies and things like that with some of the wild type fruit, that makes it a good year. But at the same time, the conditions that set us up for that to be a good wild year also are reflected in the orchard. There's less of a swing in managed orchards because we do manage them. So even though the wild trees are showing this bumper crop, the managed trees where we thinned a lot of the fruit off still had a terrific pollination period, still had you know, good dry conditions that reduced disease pressure early in the season, still had plenty of midsummer moisture to swell up the fruit when the demand for nutrients and water was the highest. So we are seeing a larger crop in managed orchards as well.
So this late summer drought or lack of rain didn't affect the apples as much as, you know, what happened earlier in the season?
Yeah, no, not really, because, you know, it actually was kind of a perfect storm, if you'll allow me to say that one.
Or perfect lack of a storm.
Perfect lack of storm. Well, there's plenty of storms midsummer, and that was an important thing, is during the spring, and especially through the bloom and the pollination and the fertilization and fruit set period, it was dry. In fact, it might have been a little bit too dry, and folks were putting water on the trees. But we didn't have a lot of disease early season, which can weaken trees. We had perfect bee flight weather, you know, sunny, 65, 70 degrees, not too much wind. We had good conditions for fruit set, which meant nice warm conditions, not too cloudy after bloom. And so we went into the summer with really heavy fruit set. Growers thinned as much as they dared to, and a lot of us thinned pretty heavily. And then when the rains did come, it came at the time when those fruit buds are starting to divide. There's a tremendous amount of resource need within the tree to divide the cells that are in those fruit. And the rains came at just the right time. And so that we were able to support a lot of rapid cell division in June through July. And then by mid-July, the cell division stops. Every cell that's going to be in an apple is there by the middle of the summer. And after that, those cells are just getting larger with the moisture that's in the ground. When you have conditions that allow for good fruit cell division, you have more cells per fruit, and you get a firmer apple, crisper apple, usually higher quality fruit, as opposed to if you just get a lot of rain in the fall and whatever cells were there would just swell up with a lot of moisture, and then you get softer, kind of insipid fruit.
Yeah, nobody likes soft, insipid fruit.
That's right.
And I love that phrase that you said earlier, perfect bee flight weather earlier. That's lovely, a lovely way to think of it. We got a note from Megan who says, we are very lucky to have a fabulous orchard in our Queechy community, which has been lovingly restored and filled with heirloom varieties that we wouldn't otherwise try. Honeycrisp used to be our go-to apple, but now we are eating Cox's Orange Pippin. These taste just like pears on salad. We're making sauce with Hughes, and I am excited to bake with some Belle de Bosse scoops once they're ready. It's also really nice to slow down and reconnect as a family outside. And we got a question from Charles in Alstead, New Hampshire, who asks, has anyone come up with an apple app to tell you where to find the varieties you want in Vermont?
Oh, is that a question to me?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know of an Apple app.
I don't know that there's an app. There is a website that I should plug. And I should actually mention, I'm no longer president of the Vermont Tree Fruit Growers Association. That now belongs to Greg Burt in Cabot.
Congratulations to Greg.
Yes, congratulations to Greg. I kind of moved on and couldn't keep on with that side of things. But the Vermont Tree Fruit Growers Association, which used to be the Vermont Horticultural Society, was founded in 1898, has a long history. They run a new website, and it was just unveiled recently. It's the same URL that they've had for probably 20 years. So it doesn't might not show up that it's this brand new site, but it really is a nice looking site. It's just vermontapples.org. And it's got a listing of all the local orchards, different varieties. It's a real nice site. It's it's designed for modern day smartphone type systems. I highly recommend that site.
Okay, good. And Charles, yeah, it sounds like no easy way, no sort of concentrated way. I just troll the farmers markets because then you wind up seeing different orchardists. And last year we had talked with Rowan Jacobson on the show, who wrote a book called Apples of Uncommon Character. And he spoke glowingly of this apple called the Westfield Seek No Further. And I had to seek very far to find it. I think I finally found it in a farmers market in Buffalo. And it was well worth the adventure trying to find it. We're talking apples today. If you'd like to share your favorite variety, maybe you can help Charles with some great varieties he should try around the state. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Any heirlooms that you're trying for the first time this year, any recipes you really want to share, maybe you've dabbled in some hard cider making, we want to hear it all. Again, go to vpr.net. We're talking with Terry Bradshaw, and he knows all this stuff about the trees, and we've been talking about what makes a good season. Let's turn now to Ezekiel Goodband. He's orchard manager of the Scott Farm Orchard in Dummerston. Zeke, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you very much.
All right. So we've been talking a little bit about apples, and we just heard from Charles, who wants to know about where to find varieties. You have a lot of varieties. Can you tick off a few of your favorites?
Oh, sure. we just started picking Orléans Rennet, which is a French Rennet that's one of my favorites, one of the most handsome apples in the world, but it's a crisp, juicy, tart apple, has a little bit of citrus and maybe a little bit of nuttiness mixed into it. It's one of my favorites. And another one, sheep's nose or black gillifleur. It's some people love it and some people are pretty indifferent to it, but I just put some in the oven the other night, and they were the best baked apple I've ever had in my life. It was a transcendent experience.
Wow.
They had a buttery texture and a little caramel and maybe some nutmeg and clove, and it was so that's one of my favorites right now for baking.
Zeke, you have been around the block, at least when it comes to apples, so that's saying something if you had a transcendent experience.
Yes, I was amazed. We often like that apple in cider. It has a lot of pectin and gives our cider a good mouthfeel or a little viscosity. So, but I was taken aback. It was so good baked. Hmm.
And what was the name of it again?
It goes by two names, black gillifleur, and the other name is sheep's nose. It's very tapered at the base. Looks like a red delicious that's holding its breath.
Have you ever tried that, Terry?
I have.
What do you think? You know, Zeke said some of these apples people are indifferent to while others love them. What about you?
Absolutely. The antiques and the heirlooms, you know, provide a whole nother palette to pick from. There's 8 or 10 varieties that you can think of that are widely popular, usually for good reason. But it certainly is nice to have other tastes and history also that goes behind those fruits. So, I love them.
So when we talk about different kinds of varieties that people can find, it seems like heirloom varieties are really coming back into favor, Zeke. And when it comes to having these heirlooms around for people to try, obviously with a tree, it's not like you put it in the ground today and it's ready to go next season. So you've sort of made this part of your career is bringing back these heirloom varieties. So were you just ahead of the curve and waiting for people to catch up, or did you have other motivations?
I grew up on a small farm. My father was a veterinarian, and he had a small orchard. It was just red delicious trees, and so we grew up, you know, harvesting and eating red delicious until they were gone in July. When I moved away, I was growing seed crops in Maine, and I thought I knew a thing or two about growing apples, and there were a lot of abandoned orchards where I lived, and I made deals with people. I'd take care of the trees and prune them in exchange for whatever I could harvest, and I'd press cider and sell apples, but I went into one orchard almost 40 years ago now, and there were blue apples and purple apples, teardrop-shaped apples, and brown-skinned apples. And I knew from my old agricultural books that these were Ben Davis and blue pearmains and sheep's nose and russets. And for me, having grown up with Red Delicious, it was like growing up with just charcoal pencil to draw with, and then being given a deluxe box of Crayola crayons as far as flavors go. It was an epiphany that there could be so many different flavors in these apples. And I knew other people were, who had grown up like me eating Red Delicious and Velveeta cheese and, the common foods of the 1950s would, also be intrigued with these different flavors. And so I started the nursery back then. And wherever we've moved, I've always brought my nursery stock or my cuttings with me. And so everywhere we go, I just graft new trees to these old varieties. And I keep finding more.
Well, and you actually lead pruning and grafting workshops every year. So are there other people like you who maybe have had a tree on their property that they want to bring back into health or have this really strong attachment to old varieties?
Oh, yes. And we, teach people how to graft, and they can go home and do that. I used to have a tree in my yard that had 50 varieties on it, so there's no limit to how many different varieties you can put on a tree. And we also have people coming to the farm stand. There are some varieties that I grow. I just have one or two trees of a certain variety because I know there are people who will drive for hours to come just to, they remember their grandfather or grandparents having this, particular apple and picking it as a child. And so they're making this nostalgic trip to find this flavor that they remember, gives them good memories of growing up. So we have some of those trees that aren't, adding to our profit line here, but they're making some people pretty happy. That's something I enjoy about doing this sort of work.
I am just picturing this magical tree that has 50 different varieties of apple on it. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, Zeke, we got a question from Bob in Glover, who has a very simple question that I realized, I don't know the answer to that either. He says, how do I know when to pick my apples?
I usually, every morning I go out into the orchard, and there might be a dozen varieties that I think are getting close to being ready. And I'll go and I'll cut them open, look at the seeds. If the seeds are still white, they're, the apple's nowhere near to being ripe. The seeds are usually a dark brown when the apple's ripe. From an evolutionary standpoint, there's no advantage to the apple to have people taking its seeds away before they're mature. So I look at the seeds, and then I taste a slice, and usually I'm, initially getting a lot of starch, and eventually I chew it longer, and if it ends up as, like a wad of paper in my mouth as I'm chewing, that's another sign that I've got to come back in another few days and taste again. Eventually, it might take me, 10 days before I go out one morning and, the sugars, there are fewer starches, it's more sugar, and the flavors that I associate with each variety are more in the foreground. And when I chew, the flesh more or less dissolves rather than wads up in my mouth. So that's how I do it. So if you have enough apples on the tree, go out and, cut one open, look at the seeds. If they're white, come back in a few days and check again and taste. After a while, you'll learn, you'll calibrate your palate to what a ripe apple should be.
Wow, that's great. Thank you so much. That's exciting to know. I mean, it makes perfect sense that, of course, the seeds would need to be, you know, that color that we always associate with them. But it never quite occurred to me that way.
Yeah.
Ezekiel Goodband is orchard manager of the Scott Farm Orchard in Dummerston. Zeke, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Terry Bradshaw is sticking with us as we talk about apples today. Coming up, we'll hear more about what kinds of new varieties you've been trying, and we'll talk about the workers who come from Jamaica to assist in the harvesting season. If you want to share your thoughts, maybe your favorite recipe, maybe you've had a transcendent experience with an apple variety like Zeke has lately, we'd love to hear about it. We'd love to share and swap ideas about what the best apples are. This is a great time of year if you live in Vermont or the Northeast to be eating apples, eating fresh apples, and finding that different variety and different flavors. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Terry Bradshaw, who oversees the UVM Horticultural Research Center, is with us today, guiding us through a discussion about this year's booming apple crop. And we're hearing from apple growers around the region. If you want to share your favorite apple picking memory or ask a question about varieties or harvesting techniques, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts or your photos on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We got a note from Rachel in Jamaica, Vermont, who says, I have been astounded by the apple trees this year, and at this very moment, I am baking Rachel and Levi's flat apple cake for a family I don't know well who are in need of a bit of apple love and nourishment. The apples I'm using are from an old orchard way back in the woods behind our house. Only two trees remain. Last year, no apples whatsoever. This year, the old trees are just exploding with beautiful apples. And let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Cambridge. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
This is a poem called Apples to Soft. It's 2 years old because we had an especially good year 2 years ago, too. Here it goes. This is a special time of year, a time for making sauce. As this time advances near, just prior to their loss, old apple trees along my road hold heavily laden boughs, ready to surrender their sweet, succulent load. The drops have barely started, but I'm chomping at the bit. Collect those apples from branches parted. There's no time to sit. Still, the morning air does beckon one to gather all, or at least as much as one can reckon, homeward toward the kettle. Heat those apples. Free the mash. Finally, I am done. But for the colander, I'd be thwarted. It separates seed and stem from flesh. Fresh sauce held in many a quart, jars in store for the cold season. Then enjoy this delicious marvel and know this little story. Apples to sauce, nouveau, tasty food for this boy.
Peter, I love it. Thank you. That was 2 years old. You're still thinking about it today, though, as we have this great season again?
Year this year in Cambridge also turns the apples, although we had 4 inches of rain last night and today, so 4.5 inches in the cup. So we'll see what that does to the apples.
Thank you for sharing your poem. I appreciate it. And let's hear from Bill Sur in Champlain Orchards. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, Jane.
Yeah.
Great. Yes, I just wanted to thank you for the coverage on Vermont apples. We are having a very good season.
So what's it like at Champlain Orchards? What are you especially excited about this year?
Yeah, well, Terry Bradshaw is involved in some research work in an orchard up in Bridport that we've planted, specifically with heirloom varieties that we're using both for the fresh market and for special hard ciders. And that's an opportunity, I think, to further educate Vermont consumers who are very supportive of all the local production that's occurring, both in apples and vegetables as well. I think we're particularly thrilled to know that there's a home for unique ciders, and there's apples. You may have heard from Zeke earlier that there's red flesh fruit that will produce a rosé cider, obviously without food coloring or other additives. It's just the apple itself expressing itself.
Bill, yeah, that's so cool, and what a neat thing to think of, you know, the different colors that you get out of that apple flesh and the apples. Thank you for calling in, Bill Sir from Champlain Orchards. Terry Bradshaw, is the cider market changing the economy for apple growers in any way? Because it is, that too is booming right now.
Yeah, it certainly is booming, and it's booming not just in Vermont but nationwide. And yeah, there's tremendous growth within the cider. When I say cider, I mean hard cider market. And it is changing the economics, but I think the picture is kind of complicated. One thing, so I used to run a little sort of hobby cider mill out of my garage for a while, and I would buy fruit on the spot market. And 5 years ago or so, prices were pretty low. I could get apples quite cheap. Growers were selling their seconds for really just a low price, and that was just to move them out the door and to keep them from littering the place. Now we've seen with demand from the cider, you know, the cideries, the hard cider market, an uptick in the price that cideries are paying, but also I think a little bit of a change in the quality they're expecting as well. So it's really changing the landscape. We aren't at a point right now where I would say, well, to some degree we are, but largely we're not at a point where growers are about to, plant acres and acres and acres of cider varieties. That said, or cider orchards. That said, there are some growers, and Bill is one who's doing it, and he's gracious enough to let me get in there, put my research hat on, and count some fruit and test some juice around these varieties. So there's a really, I'd say there's three streams of apples that are going to cideries. There's what traditionally have gone to cider or juice markets, which are, you know, our Excess, McIntosh, Empire, Cortland, you know, dessert varieties. There's what we call dual purpose varieties. So that's something that's maybe a little bit lower risk for a grower to plant because they could sell them both to the fresh market as well as to the cider market. So that would be something like Northern Spy, Golden Russet, a lot of the heirloom varieties that Zeke is growing and that Bill are growing. And then there's this other whole collection of, specific hard cider apples, many of which are from Europe, although we're starting to find some both from North America in general, but also some are being identified right here in Vermont. And there's some real pioneers out there who are digging up these fruit and trying to get them into greater production. Any of those cider-specific apples, there really is a risk in planting them because you're planting them solely for a processing market. And the economics that come in there are different from the fresh market economics. And we don't have a fully good grasp on that. But growers are doing it, and obviously there's an industry being formed around there. And so that's where I'm gearing a lot of my research, both from the horticultural standpoint to evaluate these varieties and over the next 5 to 10 years, the different growing systems that you grow them in. I can't just plant an apple tree tomorrow and have data a week later. I plant an apple tree tomorrow and I have data 5 years later. But also a lot about the economics and how can we look at the different strategies of how a grower would plant a new orchard and look at the different markets that are out there now that the cider market is a realistic market, which it wasn't, a few years ago, it was just a way to get rid of your excess. Now it's something you can plan into the operation.
Well, whether you're harvesting apples for cider or for picking, for eating, maybe you have grocery stores that you've contracted with, you need apple pickers. And there are about 300 of them who come to Vermont from Jamaica each year on a special visa to make sure the crop gets harvested successfully. On the line with us now to talk a little bit more about how the process of ensuring these workers can make it to Vermont is Allison Eastman. She manages many of these H-2A visas through her company, Bookends Associates. Hi, Allison. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
How many visas do you do the paperwork for on a yearly basis?
In Vermont, we handle roughly around 500 visas for H-2A agricultural purposes. We also serve farms in neighboring states as well.
And of course, H-2A visas are not exclusively for orchardists and for apple pickers.
Right. They're exclusive on agricultural facilities. So we do have workers that come in for veggie crops as well as poultry farms.
And it's a seasonal visa, so you can't stay on it all year round.
That's true. So the temporary visa is tied to no more than a 10-month stay. So there are some apple orchards that do have workers come here that harvest and then pack and prune.
So why Jamaica? Why has Jamaica become this tied relationship with Vermont for apple pickers?
Yes, Jamaica has been the chosen country since the 40s. And I believe the main reason is we have a treaty with the West India Islands, which allows for a visa waiver for the issuance process. So these workers do not travel on an actual work visa. They travel on an I-94.
Why are these workers essential to the process for our apple crop?
These workers have been available and willing for years to come up here and pick our crop on the seasonal need. And, you know, though in order for us to get approved, we have to advertise in Massachusetts, New York, and Vermont and hire any willing, able, and qualified U.S. domestic up to 50% of the contract. However, there is a pool of workers in Jamaica that are approved to travel for the temporary need. And one must remember that in Jamaica, you know, the minimum wage is roughly around $50 US per week. These workers are coming up here and they're picking for just under $12 an hour. Their housing and transportation is provided. So for them, they're earning an exponential amount of money. This is a great opportunity, whether they have a trade or not in their home country.
Well, and you work with a lot of orchard owners who say not only could they not get by without these seasonal workers, but they have formed really strong relationships with them over the years.
That's true. Some of our employers have had the same workers coming up for as many as 40 years. One of them in Cornwall, Barney Hodges, that used to be Cornwall Orchards. And Barney still has some of the same workers that were here under Cornwall Orchards. Now his son has taken over, and those workers are very loyal and returning year after year. You just heard from Bill Shore. I think some of Bill's workers have been coming up for 15, 16 years since Bill started that orchard. And perhaps they may have even worked for the previous owner. So they're very dedicated, loyal. They know the operations, and they're committed to coming back year after year.
Allison Eastman is the owner of Bookends Associates. Thank you, Allison. Appreciate you being on the show today.
Thank you.
She handles a lot of the paperwork for orchard owners who use the H-2A visa process to hire apple pickers from Jamaica each year. And in just a minute or two, we're going to be hearing from a performance that 20 or so workers put on last weekend in Shoreham. But Terry Bradshaw, before we do, let's get another call in here. Mark is on the line with us from North Bennington. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I'm calling to ask what a backyard orchard can do to provoke the kind of bounty that we have this year. Some years there's very few apples. And what do people do in order to augment, you know, the production of apples, both, to, you know, in a backyard operation and in a larger orchard?
Mark, thanks for the call. So, Terry, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier with you want to prune early in the season, right?
Yeah, well, actually, there's a number of steps. So really, it starts with pruning. You know, I always tell people with backyard trees that the first thing you've got to do is prune it. Is don't bother doing any other management until you've got it really cleaned up, and so you can see windows of sunlight into the tree, so the fruit buds can develop on an annual basis. They should be fertilized. You should manage pests as much as possible. And then the other important part in these heavy, heavy years is to thin the crop. And on a homeowner basis, that usually means getting out there with your hands and plucking off. You know, when a fruit cluster sets five fruit, you take out four of them. And that's what's done. That's what we do in our organic orchards. In commercial production, there's actually a hormone that's produced in the tip of the buds that is mimicked, that you can apply on the trees, and it kind of tricks the tree into thinking it's got a little bit more fruit than it does, and it helps to thin the fruit. It's really tricky to do. In fact, you can't really do it on a homeowner basis. It's not very effective on single trees. But yeah, thinning the crop is the important thing.
All right, there you go, Mark. Thin the crop. Terry Bradshaw is tree fruit and viticulture specialist at UVM. Terry, thank you so much for being on the show again.
Thank you.
And before we leave the topic of apples and apple pickers, as I said, each year, some of the workers who come to the state from Jamaica put on a concert at a local church. This past Sunday, a group of 20 of the men got together to sing hymns at the Shoreham Congregational Church to benefit organizations back home in Jamaica. Let's listen to a little bit of one of their songs.
I'm running for my life. Yes, sir. I'm running for my life. I'm running for my life. If anybody asks you,
That's a group of apple pickers from Jamaica performing the gospel hymn Running for My Life at the Shoreham Congregational Church last weekend. Coming up, VPR's Peter Hirschfeld joins us to explain how it came to be that the state is facing an unexpected spike in Medicaid costs. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Only 3 months into the fiscal year, the state is facing an unexpected spike in Medicaid that could wind up costing as much as $60 million. Here to talk about the issue and where the overrun may have come from is VPR reporter Peter Hirschfeld. Hi, Pete.
Hey, Jane.
Maybe you could actually start by reminding us exactly what Medicaid is and how much of the state's budget it represents.
Well, you can think of Medicaid as sort of a health insurance company for low-income people. But the policies that those people get through Medicaid are paid for with state and federal tax dollars, and it's a really huge enterprise. The program covers about 180,000 children and adults in the state. We're talking almost one in every three Vermonters. And it costs about $1.5 billion a year to run. That's the single largest line item in state government and close to a third of overall government spending annually. It's tough to even conceptualize a number that big, for me at least. But to give you a sense of scale, it'd take $2,500 from every man, woman, and child in the state to pay for all that.
Wow, that is a lot. And do you have a complete sense of how much this cost spike the state is looking at might actually be? I mean, we said as much as $60 million, but it sounds like it's a little bit floating.
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to keep in mind is that we're only 3 months into the current fiscal year, so the numbers are still pretty hazy. But at this point, analysts are projecting cost overruns of as much as $60 million in this fiscal year. And then it looks like there's going to be another overrun in fiscal year 2017 as well. They're thinking that could be as much as $75 million. As a percent of overall Medicaid expenses, this isn't a huge number. It's about a 2% overrun. But because the program is so large, even small overshoots like this are enough to create significant fiscal pressures. And finding the money to cover these increased costs is going to be among the most serious budgetary challenges that policymakers are going to face in the coming years. We talk about budget gaps every year, right? This is the shortfall between the projected cost to run government and the amount of revenues projected to come in to pay for it. Well, the budget gap for next year is projected to be about $50 to $70 million without the Medicaid overruns. The problems in Medicaid can end up doubling that.
Hmm. And why weren't these anticipated? I mean, where are they actually coming from, these cost overruns?
Well, that's a $64,000 question.
Or a $60 million question, as it were.
As it were, yeah. There are a couple of factors policymakers can pinpoint with certainty. The state is going to be on the hook for an extra week's worth of Medicaid payments this fiscal year. Problem is, lawmakers in the administration failed to budget for those payments, so that's $18 million right there. There are also some new drugs coming in on the market that are going to cause a few million dollars in upward pressure, but they're really working hard to figure out what the possible causes are for this as we speak.
So what happens next then, Pete? How can the state determine the specific issues contributing to the cost spike and then figure out how to deal with it now and, as you said, into future years?
Yeah, well, legislative staff is working very closely with administration officials right now to sort of ferret out the cause of the cost increases. And they're going to be looking at some possible suspects. maybe lots of people on Medicaid are using slightly more services than we anticipated. Maybe there's a tiny fraction of Medicaid enrollees that are racking up massive health care bills. Or maybe there are lots of people on Medicaid right now that don't actually qualify for the program. That's something Republicans really want to look at. The IT system used to determine eligibility wasn't working properly during the last enrollment period. So the state just kind of re-upped the Medicaid policies of everybody who was in the program at the time. There are concerns now from lawmakers in both parties that we've got a lot of people on Medicaid who make too much money to qualify for the program, and that that might be leading to some of these cost overruns.
Boy, it sounds like there are a lot of possibilities. It seems a little bit surprising that the state hadn't been trying to figure this out sooner.
Well, I think they have been. The problem is it's so massive and it's so – there's so many different things going on within the Medicaid program that it's really difficult to isolate with any specificity what's causing blips across the spectrum of Medicaid expenditures. They're going to have to do a really granular analysis. It's going to take a long time, and there are a lot of people working on that.
I'm talking to VPR's Peter Hirschfeld about an unexpected spike in Medicaid that could wind up costing the state as much as $60 million unanticipated dollars. And we're looking a little bit at why there is a spike, what the causes might be, and what can be done about it. You know, as you report on this, Pete, you say it's kind of a philosophical question in some ways, too, because the state is trying to make sure there are no uninsured Vermonters. And many of those Vermonters go on to the Medicaid rolls, and then we see, you know, it costing the state more. And so in some ways, you see this almost as a philosophical debate.
Well, you know, there's going to be general calls for better oversight of Medicaid, for improved administration of Medicaid, for changing the way that we pay for health care generally so that it just doesn't cost as much. But I think you're right. At its core, I think this is the latest springboard for this long-running philosophical debate we have in this state about how much public money Vermont wants to spend to provide health insurance to people who wouldn't otherwise be able to afford it. Only 3.7% of Vermonters don't have insurance right now. That's down from almost 10% a decade ago. And it's a statistic that ties us with Massachusetts for having the lowest rate of uninsured residents in the country. It's something that's come about in large part because we've added so many people to the Medicaid rolls. The question now is, at what cost? There isn't a lawmaker in Montpelier, I can't imagine, who doesn't want every Vermonter to have insurance. Where reasonable people start to differ is on the issue of how much government should chip in to make that happen. The rate of uninsured is going down. Increasingly, though, it's looking like we're going to have to raise more revenues than we thought in order to pay for it. And elected officials are going to have to ask, is this a policy initiative that Vermonters can afford? And if we think it is, then how are we going to pay for it?
Well, it sounds like legislators also have to ask, how much are we going to reimburse doctors who are treating patients who are on Medicaid? Because this is something that's come up previously, certainly last year. Peter Shumlin proposed an $80 million payroll tax to help boost this Medicaid reimbursement rate. That didn't go through. You think we're going to see that in 2016, given what we're facing with this spike?
You know, it's really hard to imagine that lawmakers are going to revisit a proposal like that in an election year, especially. The payroll tax was exceedingly unpopular, and I can't imagine that anybody's going to want to touch that with a 10-foot pole when you've got elections coming down the pike. But you bring up another major unresolved cost pressure in the Medicaid program, and that is the low reimbursement rates that doctors get for treating Medicaid patients. It's driving up the cost of private insurance because folks who are getting their policies from places like Blue Cross Blue Shield or MVP are having to pay more on their rates to cover the low amount that hospitals are getting to pay for folks on Medicaid. And it's making many doctors very reluctant to take on Medicaid patients because they know that they probably aren't going to get as much to take them in as they are people with private insurance. Whether lawmakers address this issue or not, it is not going to go away. And it's just another major fiscal reckoning that is going to have to happen for a Medicaid program that's under serious strain right now.
Fiscal reckoning, but sounds like maybe not in 2016.
We'll see. Like I said, hard to imagine, though policymakers are going to be under increasing pressure to get those reimbursement rates up, lest we see even more dramatic cost pressures shooting out in other directions as a result of that.
VPR's Peter Hirschfeld, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
Yesterday in our discussion about the VW emissions scandal, I misspoke in naming the lead plaintiff in a class action lawsuit that's been filed in Vermont. The plaintiff is Robert Turneau of Charlotte, and by way of disclosure, he's the spouse of VPR President Robin Turneau. We are continuing to get your comments on that story, and we will wrap them up tomorrow in a mailbag segment, so you can keep them coming at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. And Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Thanks to Melody Baudette for recording the hymn at the Shoreham Congregational Church. Liam Connors directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.